This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. While the military has used drones or unmanned aerial vehicles for quite some time, the world of drones has really opened up to normal people in recent years. For videographers, what used to take a helicopter rental can now be accomplished with a reasonably priced camera-equipped drone. And for enthusiasts, drones have advanced from flimsy toys to high-tech, highly engineered tools for fun and even for competition. But as the world of drones has advanced, so has the need to regulate their use, both for safety and privacy reasons. On today's show, we're going to explore this world. I'm joined in studio by Michael Corso. He's a board-certified business litigation and civil trial lawyer with Henderson, Franklin, Starnes, and Holt in Fort Myers, and he has a background in aerospace engineering. Michael, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined in studio by Robert Martinez. He's a founding member of the Southwest Florida Multi-Rotor Club. That's a local club dedicated to drone enthusiasts, providing tech help, camaraderie, and local competitive events through an international drone racing league known as Multi-GP, which I definitely want to explore later. Robert, thanks to you as well.
Happy to be here.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. Have you gotten into the world of drones? Or maybe you're annoyed by a neighbor who's buzzing your yard and want to know what the rules governing drones have to say. The number to call to join our conversation is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can, of course, ask a question or make a comment on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. Michael, let's start with you. Tell us a bit about your background, not only in law, but aerospace engineering and aviation and all things related.
Sure. Again, thanks for having me. Well, my story is my dad was a mechanical engineer for Boeing, so I grew up with aerospace. At age 14, I got interested in flying, began flying, soloed at age 16, got a pilot's license, continued with interest in that area by attending Purdue University and getting a degree in aerospace engineering. Often referred to as the rocket science degree. And as my partners often say, be careful with the rocket scientist jokes with Mike.
Right, exactly.
He used to be one. So I flew in the Air Force for a military commitment that I had, including doing surveillance in aircraft, which getting information from the air.
What kind of plane would that have been at the time?
That would have been an F-4.
Okay.
RF-4C. 1,500 miles an hour.
Wow.
So that kind of got my interest in the aspect of drones and getting information from the air. I ultimately, not because I didn't like aerospace, but because of some changes in the marketplace at the time I came out of school, I decided to shift to law and got a law degree and have been at it for a number of years now. And my I've continued interest in the aviation and aerospace world and continue to go to universities that teach the same, and I still fly. So that's my interest, and drones have kind of filtered into that over the last 4 to 5 years with their influx into the world.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. As an attorney, suddenly you see this something. It's like an overlap with your interest. How did you first come across the need to look to bone up on drone law?
Well, I still stay involved with the Purdue's Aerospace Engineering Department. I'm on a number of committees there where they have outsiders come in and speak. So back in the 2012-13, when drones began to be used by some public universities, including Purdue, with the auspices of the FAA, primarily for agricultural purposes, I got a little interest in it. People would ask me then, of course, with that, well, what about the law aspect of it? So probably the genesis of that started at Purdue. And since that time, I've spoken across the country on a number of groups and seminars on this kind of topic.
Gotcha. So you were probably one of the first people that they thought of at Purdue. They're like, well, we need to ask a lawyer a question about this.
Yes,
and there you were.
I'm a little bit of a maverick in that program, but then they realize, well, I know something about it.
Right. Okay, Robert, let's pivot to you. Tell us about a little bit about yourself, your background with drones, and about the club that you are a founding member of.
Well, I got into drones in 2015. Mainly out of chance, actually. A friend of mine was looking for a gift for her boyfriend. He was interested in flying radio control helicopters and asked if a quadcopter or drone would be something that would be of interest to him? And I said yes, mainly because he was like me and I was instantly enthralled by quadcopters and drones myself. Started doing my research and learning everything I could about the characteristics of drones and radio-controlled flight. And a friend of mine actually had gifted me my first drone as well. And it just literally took off from there. Just
pun intended.
Exactly. it was really interesting. It was a lot of fun. I then upgraded from the toys to the hobby grades. And that's where I started finding a real interest in competitive racing, which is where I'm at now on the competitive level. It's been a lot of fun. I've started a group with a friend of mine, a group called Southwest Florida Multirotor Club. And we have sanctioned events. We are a group of just like-minded individuals that really enjoy all aspects of drones, from building them to flying them to crashing them and rebuilding them, which is pretty much hand in hand.
Gotcha.
When you become a flyer.
Okay. Well, we'll dig further back into that here in a little bit. But before we start asking any more questions with you, we're going to take a listen to a short interview I did on Friday with a man named Tom James. He's owner of a local video production company called Pelican Media. In the interest of full disclosure, he is married to Pam James, who works in development and membership here at WGCU, and he's shot video for WGCU in the past. But let's hear that conversation now, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. Let's start with first principles. Drone, quadcopter, unmanned aerial vehicle, are they all the same? Can you explain just what that all means, what the overlap is? Because drones aren't necessarily – I mean, you know, we think of drones as these things that we fly around now, but we've also got the big, you know, drones that look like airplanes that we fly over Iraq and
I
stuff like that.
I wonder if people think that my drone is going to shoot at them, but it's not. It's, you know, there's different kinds of drones. There's fixed wings. There's the quadcopter, and there's just multiple rotors that help stabilize the drones as they fly. And there's different price levels that you can get into, different sizes of payload that they can lift. So
a quadcopter would be a kind of drone, but a drone is not necessarily a quadcopter.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. So when do you remember the first time that you know, doing something like you do with videography, where at one point in time you had to rent a helicopter? Do you remember the first time that somebody flew in with a drone and you thought, oh?
Well, I was always interested in them. We had a project shooting a landfill, and I investigated somebody who had built a large, it looked like a Bell helicopter.
How long ago would have this been, if you had to guess?
This would have been probably 10 years ago.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay.
It was still when I was in Kansas City.
Gotcha.
And it was that helicopter was able to mount my video camera to it and fly over this landfill so that we could see it. And it was problematic. I mean, it was very
– Were you nervous? New.
I was – it was my camera
yeah.
on this.
What kind of camera was it?
It was a Sony video camera.
Okay.
So, you know, $5,000, $6,000 yeah. of my money flying on his made drone. So
how much would that have cost you if you did need to rent a helicopter versus how much was it to use his drone?
$4,000 would have been a nice day of renting that helicopter to get the – and honestly, the establishing shots that we needed were, you know, a few seconds.
Right, right.
So cost effective, it's like you'd lived without getting those shots because they just weren't feasible with the budgets that we were using.
Did you feel like, wow, this is the dawn of a new world for us?
I was pushing this to do this. I really just wanted to do it. And so I investigated, found this guy that would mount my camera and – It worked for what it was. When I look at my
– You look at what you have now for a fraction of the
amazing.
Cost and it's way better?
Way better. Totally better. And
so when did you get your first drone then?
I got my first drone about 4 years ago.
Okay.
And it was – I saw them come down in price and I jumped on it. And immediately they went down in price after I
got it. Yeah, well, exactly. How much – can you reflect on the difference between the drone that you first used and what you're using now in terms of both price and in terms of performance?
Well, I have no idea what his
– Well, I meant the one you first purchased, the 4 years ago one
versus
now.
4 years ago, it is total night and day, the maneuverability, the ease of use.
It's gotten to where you don't need to do the flying all that much, right?
Pretty much.
I mean, they kind of keep – it's got like having training wheels almost, right?
It has its own flight modes that you can – and it will fly the drone. Then you can control the camera. And, of course, you're always maintaining where that drone is, whether it's flying itself or if you're flying it, because you don't want to lose that drone. And
is it always a one-man a job, or do you ever have like one person running the camera and one person running the drone?
What I personally do, I always love to have a visual observer so that they can watch the drone.
Right.
Sure,
it's like
it
your wingman.
Yeah. And then with the controls, I control the drone and the camera. But I have friends back in Kansas City that will have a crew, and one will run the camera, one will run the drone.
Are you using a drone that you attach your camera to, or are you using a drone that has come with a camera?
The camera comes gyro stabilized with the drone, so it's a nice complete package.
And it shoots like 4K or the whole nine yards.
Yep. And I shoot 4K whether I need it or not, just right. to have, you know, the extra resolution.
What are you mostly shooting then?
I am mostly shooting – well, I've done several projects with WGCU, the Preserving Our Waters. I used a lot of drone footage just to show Estero Bay with the algae. I've been trying to document a lot of that, and it just really helps to get up above it and see it. I've done some real estate projects where, you know, you're really showcasing a house on the water. It's a great way to establish its location. So it's amazing technology that now we take it for granted how easy it is. It's only been a few years.
Can you imagine how much better it might get? I mean, where are the rooms? You know, what are things that you're dealing with right now that you're like, I wish that was a little better? Or has it gotten pretty much where there's nothing that's holding you back?
Oh, there's – the sky is the limit with the drones, really. I mean, the ease of use in the one that I have now compared to the one I had 2 years ago is amazing. And if they continue that, it's just going to get better. The resolutions of the cameras will get better. The stabilization will get better. And – It takes the viewer out of, oh, this is a drone and this is an amazing shot that I'm looking at that helps tell the story that you're trying to tell. So,
you know, it's interesting. You know, I've seen the difference. I've been aware of the difference in filmmaking. You know, you're starting to see shots that were impossible shots with a helicopter or whatever.
Totally.
And now
they're safe.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it's really interesting to see how it's bled over into that world pretty quickly. Is there a lot of competition in people who are offering commercial drone services? You know, not just the enthusiasts, but are you up against lots of other people who think they can go do it because they bought a, you know, $1,000 camera drone?
Well, there is, there's a lot of that. You see them around a lot and you wonder, you know, are they? I'm commercially certified, and I took a test with the FAA, and I've learned the rules. And there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rules, and so there's a lot out there. A lot of the projects that I do are my own, so I'm not really faced with competition from somebody else trying to get that. It's my own project, and I want this establishing shot, so I'm using my drone.
How much do you have to stay on top of the rules and the regulations, and how much is that sort of uncertain territory or shifting sands?
It's a lot, and a lot of communities are deciding they don't want them, and you have to stay.
Like a homeowner association or even a municipality can pass like a local drone anti-drone ordinance?
Exactly.
Huh.
And it's your responsibility to find out if – is it legal for me to fly here? I've turned down a lot of projects that are in airspace or on property that I can't access. So
how do you determine that? Is there a repository for that? That sounds like that could be complicated.
There's really not. And I wish that there was a little bit more. I was doing a project with the state, with state parks, and a lot of those aren't allowed. Drones aren't allowed on the property. And so you have to, who do I need to get permission from, because I'm not just anybody here. I'm doing a project for you. And they still had quite a bit of regulations and rules and their guidelines of what they wanted that just didn't make it feasible to shoot. So I didn't use it.
Is that mostly being done for safety? Is it mostly being done for privacy? A bit of both?
A bit of both. You know, if I can see on public lands if a drone mishap happened with other guests, and you know, a lot with national parks, I know they don't want to disturb somebody's serenity in a national park.
Right.
With a bzzz. It sounds like the bees are attacking.
Right.
So I can see a lot of it. And I can also see that there's, you know, many opportunities that I've lost because it just doesn't work out. So
what are your thoughts on this idea of using drones as delivery vehicles? I know that's not necessarily your expertise, but, you know, it's being bandied about.
Is there a curse button? Because
I can bleep it.
when you do the commercial certification and look at the rules. There's rules against it, so there would have to be, you know, law changes. I don't think that it would be feasible. I don't understand the big push for it, but that's, you know, somebody with more money.
So you feel like it's sort of a solution to a problem we don't have, maybe?
Yeah, I think they're trying to think outside the box, which is great, but I think they're trying to force a square peg into a round hole. And
what do you think of in terms of privacy concerns? Drones keep getting smaller and smaller. At some point, they're going to be small enough to be, you know, used surreptitiously to gain access to places. You know, it's already – I've seen it in movies as science fiction, but I'm not sure it's entirely science fiction anymore.
Well, it's – I mean, even the drones that we have now, people are using them surreptitiously to, you know, in ways that they shouldn't be doing it. And that it's frustrating for somebody, you know, when I get a lot of pushback using my drone in a community because people are worried about privacy. And honestly, I'm focused on this element. I don't care about your property or your, you know.
That's not why you're – yeah, that's not why you're there.
And honestly, the, you know, in the altitudes, you know, I'm limited at 400 feet above sea level to shoot. And at that level, you're unidentifiable, so don't worry.
Well, until we're shooting at 16K.
Well, yeah. And, you know, there's people that will fly it in people's windows, and
yeah.
that's ridiculous. I can't imagine why they would do that, and it's not what I'm about. And I get a lot of pushback because people think that's what you do with a drone.
Right.
Because they hear it.
Do you have any drone mishap stories?
Oh, the second time I flew my first drone, I put it about 60 feet in the mango tree and just was watching the wonderful video that it was actually getting and not where it was going. And
lesson learned.
And I the last thing I saw were leaves, and I'm like, well, that's not good.
You were able to get it out?
With the help of the fire department. They graciously...
How resilient are these things? You know, it seems like they've gotten to where they can kind of take a beating. They're kind of modular and they're meant to be wrecked a little bit. Obviously, you don't want to wreck anything, but
– Certainly. Yeah. And they're pretty durable. And, you know, the rotors are the most sensitive pieces, and those are easily purchased and replaced. And so,
are you required to carry any special insurance? Is there a drone insurance or something like that?
I always get it. You know, there's places that will, you can get it for an hour. So you're not, you know, you don't have a large blanket policy because a lot of insurance companies just, you know, when I told them I had a drone, they said, no, thank you. So there's certain companies that you can get. Verifly is the one that I use where it's an app on the phone that will determine my location. And I can buy for 30 minutes, an hour, how long, however
really?
Long
so there's flying. That's pretty high tech.
It's very high tech, and they are continually improving it, for the amounts that you can get and the type of coverage that you can get. But it's going to cover my liability. It won't cover my drone. If something breaks on it, that's on me. But at least if I'm flying near people, near properties, I'm covered.
What is the enforcement mechanism if you go to 420 feet? Is it somebody would have to have reported you? There's no – I mean, there's an app there that you can do – I mean, how might someone know if you were going a little outside the lines?
I don't really know the enforcement of that. I know that if there's an incident, you know, they can track your logs and see where you were.
So you're logging your flights? That's part of your
– My software. flight. It determines the GPS where that location is and how long.
So you're on record when you're using it for your job.
Pretty much.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Well, yeah. that's just something I wouldn't have even thought of.
Well, that's something that the software for my drone does. But you're supposed to maintain a log. You're supposed to maintain a maintenance log to make sure that you're keeping your equipment safe to be flying around in the public. And that's just what the FAA requires, just because if you're in their airspace, you got to play by their rules. And
are the drone enthusiasts of the world typically doing that as well, do you think, or do you even know?
I don't really know about the enthusiasts of the world. They have a different set of rules if you're not commercial. I really don't know.
Well, we'll find that out later during this show.
Exactly.
This is a sort of last question. Any favorite drone footage that you've captured that for whatever reason, you remember as being, because it's always nice to get some really good footage of something.
Yeah. I really think it's, the Preserving Our Waters project that I did with WGCU. Estero Bay is, my favorite water. It's right here in our neighborhood, and to be able to get some great looking shots and showcase that, sites that people just normally don't see of it, and you can really learn to appreciate a lot more that water by seeing it from a different vantage point. So,
any concerns ever flying over water with an expensive piece of equipment?
Total, and especially salt water, it'll be gone. So it's the sacrifice that you make to get the shot that you need. So you just settle in.
All right. Well, any final thoughts?
No, I just, I love the flexibility and the different shots that they can give. And that's why I choose to use it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Tom James, owner of Pelican Media. To see some of the Preserving Our Waters footage Tom referred to, visit our webpage, gulfcoastlive.org. Turning now back to our in-studio guests, let me reintroduce them. Michael Corso is a lawyer with a background in aerospace engineering. He's with Henderson, Franklin, Starnes & Holt in Fort Myers. And Robert Martinez is a founding member of the Southwest Florida Multi-Rotor Club. That's a group that connects and supports local drone enthusiasts. If you'd like to join our conversation about drone use, give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Okay, for starters, let's get to some of the questions that Tom couldn't answer. Michael, talk about certification and he had to go through and take some FAA training and or explain what it is for a commercial drone user. What hurdles do they have to overcome?
The general rule is if you're going to use a drone for business or commercial purposes that you've got to comply with the FAA regulations. There are two aspects to it currently. One is called Section 333 out of the FAA rules. It is more formal. It was the original one that was required. And you actually have one of the requirements is that you have a pilot's license, a traditional pilot's license. There's an application process that you have to go through. And that was the original one that was done with drones starting about in 2014. Later in 2016 and then 2017, because of I'll call it an uproar of the community dealing with the drones and the interest in them and people not wanting to and facing being a pilot, hiring a pilot
right.
to control these, they created what was now known as Part 107, which is the other avenue by which commercial or business use can be done. And I believe Mr. James referenced apparently doing that because he talked about – and the phraseology there is they talk about a remote pilot certificate.
Okay.
There's a formal training program that you can go through. Businesses have cropped up that provide and do these
programs. Help facilitate that for people.
They do. And that and basically it's to get the person to appreciate the rules of the road, if you will,
right.
in this case the rules of the air. And so you would have to do that. You'd have to register also your drone, which is done for the purposes of primarily to identify them. If there is a problem, who owns it?
Yeah,
because they're pretty generic looking. So those would be the two means by which you would legally do it.
What about enforcement mechanism? It's sort of like one of those things that, there's rules for it, but there's not nearly enough people out there enforcing it to make it Well, you explain.
Yeah. That's I just recently gave a presentation to the Florida Engineering Society in Marco, and that was one of the questions of that group. In reality, at the current time, there's very little enforcement by the FAA. They have enough things on their hands to coordinate and integrate drones into the airspace system in the United States, and that's still an ongoing process. So although there are FAA inspectors that go around and check on aircraft, et cetera, to drill down into the drone world is not. So it would take, you know, someone to complain and make an issue about it, or in worst case scenario, a horrible or
tragic circumstance
to really get their attention. So right now there is not a strong enforcement area. The FAA and the federal government has suggested that, well, perhaps the local law enforcement agency should be more interested in that. And we represent some. And frankly, they're not – that's a whole new beast or animal to them. Mm-hmm, and they have enough issues with that's not something they fully want to get into. On the other hand, they get calls. We represent one local law enforcement agency that someone shot one down. And the gentleman who shot it down, so to speak, turned himself in, said, I got this drone with some pellets in it. And, you know, somebody was flying over it. Never could be determined whose it was or who did it. Again, chasing someone in that regard is a little different. As far as the last thing on enforcement, that's kind of on the law side from the FAA. Florida now has a statute in which individuals can actually have a statutory cause of action against someone taking images of them without their permission.
Okay.
And creates a civil remedy that you could go to court on. Doesn't say how much you could get. But it gives you a civil remedy to actually go into court, and that came about in 2015 in the state of Florida.
Real quick, back to the guy who shot the drone down. Where does the law fall on that if it's over your property, or how – I guess the second question is how high up does my property go?
Well, that's what everybody asks, and my typical answer to that is certainly with the requirements of not going above 400 feet is probably one indication. But in essence, the FAA takes the position that the federal government controls all airspace in all ways. So hypothetically, the air above your house and outside is not very far up. The FAA would say they have some jurisdiction. So, but in reality, a couple hundred feet, certainly up to 400 feet. Certainly, you have a right to privacy. And so in this gentleman's case, apparently it came over his pool area and he had two teenage daughters. So I think I know why it was over his property. But he shot it down. Now it is somebody else's property. And I understand that perhaps there may be some small claims court cases out there, particularly in California, where someone has shot down or somehow brought down a particular drone or UAV.
And last follow-up to something Tom brought up, this idea that, you know, whether it be municipalities or homeowners associations that could implement some sort of local rules, where does that play out?
Well, that's at first the FAA took the position and still does in a large sense that, again, they are the power that be and it's all them. But they're more interested in the control of the airspace. Privacy issues are not of great concern to the federal government, so they leave that to the state and local government. So it's certainly – and that's true in all areas of the law, not just related to drones. So there can be. And in fact, that same Florida statute that I mentioned, 934.50, specifically says that a state or political subdivision can enact a local government can enact laws that relate to nuisances, to restrictions, endangerment to property, and other illegal acts in that regard. So Florida law certainly allows states to do it, and I can't help but mention it because he mentioned it right here in Lee County, Bonita Springs.
Oh, yeah?
The town of Bonita Springs has a municipal law that says that drones may only be flown at a community park and may only occur when the fields are unoccupied and it's unlawful for drones to fly within 25 feet of people, power lines, buildings, or light fixtures. And I think that came into being
about a year and a half ago. That would give a homeowner or somebody sort of a leg to stand on if they lived in Bonita Springs to have some sort of recourse, I suppose.
Correct. And the state statute, I think, would cover everybody else in the broad sense of if they were, their in privacy was invaded.
Gotcha. Robert, let's pivot to you now. The other thing that he mentioned is that, you know, he has an app that kind of is tracking where he is, when he's doing it. He's able to get insurance through that. Is that stuff that bleeds over into the world of enthusiasts, or is that something that you guys don't have to really worry about?
Well, the type of flying that we do in racing typically happens on an open field where we've got permission to fly.
Gotcha.
I would like to say that 95% of the drone community that are flying are usually involved with some sort of community like the AMA.
What's that?
The American Modelers Association.
Okay.
Where these guys, they as a member of the AMA, they have some protections, and it's basically an advocacy group for RC enthusiasts and drones as it relates. The kind of neat thing about the AMA with your membership, you do kind of have a what they call like a second-tier insurance policy through them. So if there was a mishap that for most parts your homeowner's insurance or your own private insurance didn't cover, mm-hmm. the AMA would then step in with what you had through your membership as far as insurance. So if you're not flying commercially, it's not necessarily something that you know we're worried about going to go get right away.
Gotcha.
That's actually the first time I've heard of that application and that ability to do that.
Yeah,
that's actually
that kind of blew
intriguing.
My mind. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about this drone racing thing. I've seen videos. You know, I've followed the world of drones for a while, and it's gotten to the point where, you know, am I mistaken in saying that you are putting on VR goggles and pretend like you're in the pilot seat? I mean, has it gotten that far?
Well, there's actually no pretending about it. in all reality, that's exactly what you're doing. What am I trying to say here? Unlike a photography drone, those cameras are designed to shoot your cinematic footage, your pictures, your videos.
And rotate around.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
The cameras that are on racing drones are for one purpose, and that is to fly and actually know exactly where you're going.
And provide you with a good view that would recreate what it's like to be inside a cockpit.
The field of view on most cameras are similar to kind of like the GoPro, the action cameras.
You have about, like a wide shot.
Yeah, you have about anywhere between 100 to 120 degree field of view, which is good when obviously flying at a kind of high rate around trees. And
how fast are these things flying?
The typical speed in a race will probably get anywhere between 60 to 70 miles an hour. Last summer, one of our members actually had the world record for the world's fastest drone, and his clocked in just under 150 miles an hour. Battery life dies really quick.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of distance you can cover in that amount. But as of right now, I think they are approaching 200 miles an hour as far as what they can do. Again, when you're flying, even at the racing speeds of 50, 60 miles an hour, there's not much pretty photography that you're going to get.
Sure, sure. But let's talk a bit about this world. Is this just amateur fun? Is this competitive? Are there leagues? Are there people making money doing this? Is this something we're going to watch on TV? Show us the brave new world of drone racing.
Actually, it is on TV now. As of, I think, 2 years ago, ESPN started playing what they called the DRL, the Drone Racing League, where they went around, you flew in a local competition, you submitted your tapes and to see if you were invited to compete. And their first event was actually at Joe Robbie Stadium in Miami.
They saw some footage of that. They were flying through the tunnels.
Yes. A lot of tech was involved in order to make that happen. Most of the time, the drone and the pilot kind of have to – their antennas have to be able to see each other. But these guys were flying in the hallways.
Oh, right.
So there was a lot of extra stuff involved in order to make that happen that we don't necessarily have at our fingertips. But
had you done any flying before, except maybe in a video game? What was the learning curve like?
The learning curve is actually pretty. It's not as complicated as you'd think. Michael and I were talking a little bit earlier about one of the big draws for the younger guys is that it's so similar to a game controller.
Mm-hmm.
That it literally is something almost like a video game, but instead of, you know, seeing it on your TV, you're doing it in real life. So that actually helps a lot of these new pilots in their curve as far as getting to a level where they can actually perform pretty well.
Hmm. When is your next race, or you know, how can somebody see this in person if they wanted to?
Well, there's actually a lot of local chapters around Florida and around the United States. MultiGP is actually an international race league. So,
do you get a crowd? Do people show up? Is it like a spectator sport yet, or is it still pretty much just the?
It's growing in interest, and that's the neat part about it. When it first was put together and organized, it really was about the pilots. It really was about, hey, you know, let's get a bunch of guys that all fly together and let's have a race and let's compare ourselves to what some other guys across the country are doing. That's what MultiGP allows us to do. As far as a spectator sport, because of its popularity now on ESPN and a lot of people asking questions about it, the inexpensiveness of finding a toy drone, you can buy in Walmart or Target or Amazon, it brings about a level of curiosity. So if we were to actually promote a drone race more on a local level through, you know, regular, you know, media outlets, you know, more than just our Facebook page,
right?
We probably would get a little bit more of a spectator crowd. But most of the time, it's our families and it's our friends that come out to cheer us on, support, and check it out. Sometimes people are driving by and they're like, "Wow, what was that?" And
yeah.
They'll stop in and look at it and
a curiosity, listen, yeah, if nothing else.
Right,
I
saw that on TV. That's fantastic.
Huh. And then, Michael, you're a pilot. You've flown planes, like real planes. Have you done any drone flying?
I have any racing that Robert's
ever
about.
Using VR goggles.
No,
I'd be interested to see what that would be like for an actual pilot to be in that position.
Yeah, no, I've not done that. There are the flight by view is part of and can be of flying a drone that, you know, from that standpoint, but that's not what goggles on.
Right.
No, I haven't done the goggle part. So it's been more recreational and fun and just to do it. I haven't done it commercially or otherwise.
We have a question that's come in from Twitter from Calusa Waterkeeper. So this is somebody who the show sort of knows. He monitors water quality throughout the region, and especially right now because of the algae blooms. If we suspect contamination or illicit discharges, what right do we have to fly over private property? So if somebody wants to get a look at a creek that's not on public land, is that against the law? What's the rule say?
Well, again, it would be where they're located. Generally, I would say it probably could very well be an invasion of privacy, mm-hmm. and a trespass in that regard, because that normally one thinks of the ground, but it can be up above. Then you have the FAA jurisdiction above that. So I think short of property appraisers who have a statutory exemption to fly over
property.
They do.
Okay.
They do in that same statute I mentioned before. Surveyors that are in the business of surveying things often can – even on land, they can actually trespass on someone's property.
Right.
My technical legal advice would be that if you intend to fly somewhere that it's not – it's private property and so on, that you best get permission of someone. Otherwise, there could be an issue. Where it will go after that, is another thing. But at the same token, that's probably the better advice to do.
You know, it's interesting. As I think about it, it would be one thing to see, like if I'm a landowner and I see a drone over my property, that's one thing. But what if you went on the internet and you saw your property from the air? Would that be enough evidence to go to the authorities and say, this person was on my property, because here's footage of my property from directly above my property?
It could be.
Huh.
It could be.
It's a brave new world.
Huh? It is.
If you're just joining the show today, we're exploring the world of unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. My guests are attorney Michael Corso from Henderson, Franklin, Starnes & Holt, and Robert Martinez, who's a founding member of the Southwest Florida Multi-Rotor Club. That's a group that connects and supports local drone enthusiasts. Have you gotten a drone and have a question or comment, or maybe you want to know what your rights are about your property? If you see somebody operating a drone around it or above it. The number to call to join our conversation is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. So we've gone over the privacy implications in terms of, you know, private property and things like that. I want to throw out this idea that, you know, what happens when somebody can go on, say, Amazon and buy a fly that is a drone? Because we're going to get there, right? I mean, technology is heading down that road. So what happens when somebody has a drone that's so small that they can go anywhere? Any reflections on that? Because it seems like that's at the end of our rainbow somewhere.
Well, they can be small. I know they have what they call spider versions that are basically about the size of your hand, I think, are probably the one of the smaller ones that can handle a camera, because
right.
normally somebody wants to have it for photography purposes.
Right.
Well, I it would be like all forms of privacy cameras.
Right.
Security cameras are a form of that, and there can be issues with those as to where they're located, et cetera. So I don't know that the rules would change any. I would have a little problem with one being so small that what kind of equipment would they be able to have on it to be able to take anything significant in terms of any visual evidence of that.
Robert, is this am I in science fiction territory here, or what? You're somebody who builds them. What do you think?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the main thing I think for anybody that's really worried about a drone and privacy, regardless of how small they are, remember that this is a propeller-driven vehicle that has to beat the heck out of the air around it in order to get somewhere. So it's going to make some noise. I mean, in all reality, we can hear a mosquito buzzing around us.
Yeah,
we can hear
okay.
a fly, a hornet. So something with four blades carrying a camera has a little bit of weight on it. It's probably going to pique your interest. And, hey, what's going on around me? I've always kind of wondered, you know, people that say, oh, this guy was flying a drone out of my window. I didn't see it until I looked out the window. Well, I mean, the drones that are capable of doing that have big flashing LED lights on
right.
and they're pretty noisy. So if it gets down to the size of a fly, I got to imagine we're still going to be able to hear it. We're going
right.
to visually be able to see it. I think most of the time if we're going to be worried about somebody taking some intrusive video of us, it's not going to be something flying. It's going to be something that somebody's wearing.
Right. And there you go. Well, let's talk also a little bit about the drone building. This is something that you've gotten into, correct?
Yes.
So how much difference is there between, you know, the $100 drone that you can buy off the shelf, the $500 drone you can buy off the shelf, and then what you're building if you want to put your parts together?
Mainly the technology. Most of the time when you're buying a let's say like a Phantom or a Mavic drone, which is the aerial 4K video photography drones, they have a lot of tech, not just to get it to fly, but also to control the camera. These cameras have two and three position gimbals
mm-hmm.
to allow them some very nice stabilization. On the toy end of it, or even in the racing aspect, none of that tech is needed. It adds a lot of weight. Again, the technology designed for flying a race drone is pretty much minimal, mainly because of we want to build the drone that's as light as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas a lot of these – the camera drones also run GPS flight controllers. They're carrying a lot more tech and a lot more
– Gotcha.
Equipment that costs – that has a cost involved with it. Whereas a race drone, our modes are very simple. We do have a flight control version where the flight control actually will balance the drone and keep it upright for you, but that's about it. And then we have what we call full acro, where all the accelerometers, all the gyroscopes that the flight controller has are turned off. And us as the pilot are responsible for keeping it upright, keeping it at
the
angles
that we want. Is there a big learning curve there? I have a friend who made his own drone, and he went from, oh, this is easy, to this is impossible.
there is a bit of a curve. The flight controllers really help out when you're learning, because it's like training wheels. It keeps your quadcopter upright. You don't have to worry about keeping it balanced. You literally have four motors and four propellers, and getting them to work together can get hairy really quick. The flight controller usually takes care of that with an accelerometer. Honestly, the ability to have it helps a lot of people get past it. But after a while, when you get better and better at it, and then you start flying with FPV, the goggles and the cameras on there, you notice that you're actually starting to fight the flight controller itself, trying to keep it, because you want it to do a little bit more, and it's trying to balance itself out. So eventually, you get to a point where, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and turn it off, and then you're going to be wobbly for a while, but after a while, you smooth out, and you're able to fly this thing wherever you like.
Are quadcopters where it's at mostly? I mean, Tom earlier referred to there's some that have more than four. Or what are some of the outliers, and how common are they?
For racing, the quadcopter is king. There's a bunch of different versions of them. There's a bunch of different frames. Some guys flip their motors upside down. Some guys have some where the motors are a little bit more forward and backwards of the quad. Other ones are true X style, as they're called. They both have their good and bads. It all depends on what you're really trying to do.
Is anybody flying an airplane anymore?
Oh, you know, yeah.
Because I remember when I grew up, I'm like, oh, yes. I really wish I could fly a remote control airplane, but the only thing I had was the one you can spin around in circles at the end of a string.
Yeah.
I mean, is that still?
Absolutely. And again, the advent of FPV technology has taken that to another level as well.
Hmm.
Whereas before, you were kind of flying on the ground and watching your plane fly around, to be able to actually, quote unquote, be on board and fly from that perspective it's almost magical in all reality. It really is.
I was going to add fixed wing, which can be a drone also. Surveyors use a good bit because of their larger, and they can have a larger battery, have a longer life to run rows or sections that they are doing. So they're not just all
quadcopters
or octocopters or whatever, but the fixed wing is also prevalent in many areas.
And that's a perfect pivot to what I was going to ask you next, Michael, is, you know, what are some of the other uses for drones that people might not think about? You've alluded to agriculture. You've alluded to surveying. Is agriculture a place that this is happening to?
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, it kind of started there in the government and the FAA allowing public universities that had agriculture departments,
mm-hmm,
of checking crops, how they're growing, insects and control, and being able to see it. Obviously, on the ground, the farmer has a little difficulty in going down the rows of corn to see everything. And so they could go up above and they could see an area that's dry or drier than others. So it really, agriculture is a large one, particularly out west and in the Midwest it's used. Locally or other places, engineering and construction companies, mm-hmm, use it a lot as it relates to building, taking photographs of construction as it's going along, pre-construction type things, inspection of buildings. I have a structural engineering client who does bridges, and opposed to getting on a boat or other means,
he flies up underneath,
and with the quality that others have mentioned about the photography, they can detect cracks and issues in it without having to rent a boat and perhaps not be as efficient, frankly, as they might be. So that's somewhat happens a good bit in Southwest Florida because of the construction activity.
I could see science too, you know, like, you know, marine science, maybe you can look at the, you know, because you have cameras now, like satellites have cameras that can use different spectrums and whatnot. I would presume you can do the same thing with a drone.
Same thing. I think the people have mentioned going across in the algae on the rivers. I've heard them being used in some communities for looking for sharks along a beach.
Right.
Because of the quality of the camera, they can pick up shadows and using those for that application. So absolutely, there's lots of uses out there.
Absolutely.
Any other uses that people might not think of that you would think of, Robert?
Oh, there's plenty. I have a friend of mine who does some drone flying for the Collier County Sheriff's Department as well. They have the ability to use that. They're using FLIR cameras, a forward-looking infrared, and they're able to fly at night. And I think there was, matter of fact, I saw the video from it on YouTube, where there was an elderly person who had gotten lost, and she was. When they found her, she was literally maybe 30, 40 feet from the edge of the road, but nobody could see her because of how dark it was.
But they could see her at night.
Exactly, without a problem. There's a lot of uses and a lot of tech for these drones to be able to do. Like Mike had mentioned, as far as the agriculture aspect, these guys are even – they're able to apply insecticides and pesticides to their fields. The cameras are able to detect – how much water flow from one side of a field to the other is there? There's so many different aspects that can be applied and where drones can be useful.
Michael, you recently spoke to the Engineering Society. Do you have any of those other events lined up? And how much do you think things are going to keep changing before we settle into something?
I do have some of those. A smaller aspect of engineers, coastal engineers, and most of them are located in Florida because of the coastlines we have. They have an annual meeting in Clearwater in September, and they heard about me speaking to the larger group of engineers in Marco. So I'll be heading up there to give them a little program on the drones and the law. So yeah, that interest is out there. And you know, it's from primarily people that see applications for it there. So I think it's going to stay out there. Now, as far as the projection as to the laws, I think the FAA created in 2017 a program dealing with the integration of drones into the airspace and refining it down to more definitive type of rules and or technology. And there were 10 test sites listed, and believe it or not, one of those is the Lee County Mosquito Control Board here in Lee County out of Buckingham. They were one of the 10 national that were selected to assist in testing and evaluations of programs like that. That's – I don't know where that's going to lead, but it's underway, the program in terms of testing at Purdue University that I'm connected with. Is very involved with the national system of air traffic control going from land-based radar to satellites for better efficiency and coverage. And they also are involved in, again, the integration of other things. But one of the larger aspects that they will have with drones is detection of them, which is very difficult.
Right.
I mean, they're so small that they cannot be detected very easily by radar or radar-type devices.
We only have a minute or two left, but real quick, did you see the situation in Venezuela that unfolded recently where there was presumably an assassination attempt with a bomb on a drone?
Yes, and we've talked about all positive uses of them, and there are certainly negative ones. And just to round it out, just since I'm here more for the law, Florida does have a statute 330.411 that says a person may not possess or operate an unmanned aircraft or system with an attached weapon, firearm, explosive, destructive device, or ammunition. So there's actually a law
there's a
in Florida
red line
that you,
on that one,
but that can happen.
All right. And Robert, just real quickly, we basically run out of time. How can people learn more about your club and what's the best way to get in touch with you for that?
They can do a search on Facebook for Southwest Florida Multirotor Club. I definitely would like everybody, if they would like to learn more about drone racing, to check out multigp.com as well.
All right.
A lot of great information.
We have links to both of those things on our website.
Great.
So check it out there at gulfcoastlive.org. That is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to my guests. Michael Corso is a board-certified business litigation and civil trial lawyer with Henderson Franklin Starnes and Holt PA in Fort Myers. Michael, thank you for being here. It was informative and fun.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thanks also to Robert Martinez. He's a founding member of the Southwest Florida Multi-Rotor Club and a drone builder and racer. Robert, thanks for coming in for the show.
Absolutely.
It was great.
Thank you.
And thanks to my earlier guest, Tom James, owner of Pelican Media. Our show today was produced by myself and Rachel Iacovone. Our director today is Kevin Trueblood. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.